podcast is brought to you by
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Are you tired of the same old breakfast routine? Do you want something quick, easy, and delicious to start your day? Introducing Sam's Toaster Pastries, the hottest new breakfast treat that's taking kitchens by storm. These melt-in-your-mouth pastries come in wild flavors like chocolate explosion and strawberry supernova, popping right from the foil pouch into your toaster. And in just seconds, you've got a piping hot pastry overflowing with sweet fruity filling. The flaky crust and gooey center make these little rectangles of joy perfect for grabbing on your way out the door. Take your mornings from blah to yee-haw with Sam's Toaster Pastry. Find them in the breakfast aisle at your local grocer. Sam's Toaster Pastries, a heck of a way to start your day.
Here we go.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Need you cool. Are you cool? I'm cool.
Are you gonna bark all day, little doggy, or are you gonna bite?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
I'm a killer. I'm a murdering bastard, you know that? And there are consequences to breaking the heart of a murdering bastard.
You really only need to hang mean bastards. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
You hear me talking, hillbilly boy? I'ma get medieval on your ass.
You'll be shot for this?
Nah, I don't think so. More like chewed out. I've been chewed out before.
Hey, is everybody okay?
The fucking hippies aren't. That's for goddamn sure.
Kill white folks and they pay you for it. It's nothing like starting to see pictures, ain't you?
Well, gentlemen, you have my curiosity. Now you have my attention.
Welcome all you inglorious bastards to another edition of Pulp Reflection, the monthly series dedicated to taking a retrospective look back at Pulp Fiction as it turns 30. I'm your host, the Reverend Scott K, and on this month's episode, aptly titled A Wife, A Watch, and A Pulpy Situation, we will be taking an in-depth look at Pulp Fiction's unique narrative structure and how it impacted the modern storytelling of both film and television. Joining me for this discussion is friend of the show and co-host of the Spectre Cinema Club podcast and host of the new Courage the Cowardly pod, it's Mr. Devon Taylor. Welcome back, Mr. Taylor, and may Tarantino be with you always.
Tarantino is always with me, and especially as, doing multiple episodes of Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is just a stream of consciousness now.
You're mainlining it now. You're fucking, you're Vincent Vega. You're just fucking slapping your inside of your arm and mainlining us in. That's what we got to do.
Hey, at least I know what it is, versus Mia just being like, oh, I'm just going to snort whatever powder I see. Whoops.
This is true. This is very true. I mean, hey, what are you going to do? Look, if he had balloons, we wouldn't have been in this mess in the first place. Very However, true. If he has balloons, her and Vince may have, bumped uglies, and then someone's dead anyway, so.
That's so funny. I never even now that you said it out loud, it totally makes sense, because when I was rewatching earlier, I was like, what's the difference between baggies and balloons? I was like, oh, okay, that does make sense for, drug heads for identifying,
Yes.
Of course, even drug acts got to be organized.
Yes. Your grandparents know. Come on. Grandma saw the balloon. She knew grandpa was getting a little high tonight. Well, Mr. Taylor, you're back for your second go round. You'll be on one more time this year. We get you in early and quick. As we record, we're just almost a week past your first debut, which was for the character study you did, Mr. Jules Winfield. Mm-hmm. As we record now, obviously, you'll be on in April. And then at the end of May, you'll be joining our Kill Bill Volume 2 20th Anniversary Celebration Panel. So that'll be your three.
That one will be coming out around the time of my birthday. So that's really nice.
Boom. And then you got the summer, fall, winter, and we say goodbye to you, and you'll come maybe so soon before.
I'll find a way to come bug you sometime before the end of the year.
You'll have to. I'm going to get some of these people hooked on Pulp Fiction so much that it's going to be, you're going to have like a wall behind you with like lines trying to draw conclusion. So,
I mean, that's my notes for this one as we're, you know, breaking down the storytelling and stuff. I was like, okay, like, let me see what's the proper chronological order, which pieces go here.
Yes.
Can't put string in a Word document, but I would if I could.
Not yet. You can't. AI will let you soon. But, you know, since we last talked, you're on the precipice of launching a brand new show called Courage the Cowardly Pod, a podcast based on an amazing cartoon from Cartoon Network that was pretty much on in the early to mid-2000s that my children also watched, because my kids are now in their early and mid-20s, so it really dates me, obviously. But Courage the Cowardly Dog, a phenomenal fucking show. So fucking good. The animation, the storytelling, it is really a cult classic. How has that show been going for you, and how are things now on Spectre Cinema?
Yeah, going into Courage has been so much fun. Like, I mean, the amount of YouTube videos of like iceberg theories I've been watching, and like, you know, people have like a psychological analysis on like the different villains and stuff. Like, so like the research portion is like super fun to like kind of go a little bit in depth. And, you know, and I wanted to do this because, you know, I love gateway horror. For sure, I got into horror pretty young, and it was big between, you know, Scooby-Doo and Courage. And like, I mean, I love Scooby-Doo as well, but there's a million Scooby-Doo podcasts. Mm-hmm. So I was shocked to see that nobody was giving Courage the love that he deserved, and in a completely different way of like kind of being a gateway to like surreal horror. Mm-hmm. And like, it's like kind of bizarro stuff, and like, you know, and these like kind of they hit a lot different when you watch them as adults versus when you were watching them as kids, and you kind of see the different nuances in it. So like, been super excited. It's been super fun, and we're gonna do like episode by episode, but then I'm also gonna break it up with like some like villain ranking episodes. Working on getting some interviews from some of the people that worked on the show. So we'll be breaking it up with other stuff like that besides just the episode to episode breakdowns. But yeah, super fun.
That sounds very exciting, and I am looking forward to it, as I hope a lot of my listeners are as well. Because while I have a pretty strong Gen X following, there's also a pretty strong millennial following. And I feel like if you're a Gen Xer and you had kids, you probably watch this with your kids. And if you're a millennial, you probably, or even Gen Zs, is that what they're called now? Gen Zs? Whatever you are, the generation mm-hmm. between us and the millennials, or after the millennials, you would have definitely watched this as kids. And it's a fucking fantastic show. And, you know, Cartoon Network, I'm not going to take a dump on it. Still got good stuff, but some of the great stuff has come and gone. And man, the Halcyon days seem to be over. And that's a little disappointing, but we always now have Courage and Rerun. And we're now going to have a podcast to keep it alive.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm super stoked on it. And on Spectre Cinema Club, it's actually apt timing, at least for when this drops, because we are for April covering anthology horror.
Ooh.
So with this, you know, being a kind of pseudo anthology film within itself,
yes.
I'm excited to like kind of continue on breaking down the various structures of anthologies.
Are you doing Black Sabbath by chance?
No, that one is not on there. We'll be we're going to be ranking every segment in the VHS franchise. We got Quaidon in there. We got Southbound, and then some other goodies as well. So yeah, right. Very excited.
Well, if you ever do a second one of those, Black Sabbath is what kind of gave this film that we're going to be talking about today its kind of blueprint for how it would do a three-story anthology wrapped inside itself. So, you know, just a little heads up there from the Church of Tarantino.
Throwing it on the watch list right now.
There you go. Now, what is your now personal connection to Pulp Fiction? Because when we last spoke, when we were talking about good old Jules, the man, the myth, the bad motherfucker himself, you had only watched this about 3 times. Now, I'm not saying you've had to watch it many times since, but I do feel like you are being pulled into the vortex of Pulp Fiction at 30 that is completely entwined my life now. Like, I realizing, like, once this year is over, I don't think I could ever talk about Pulp Fiction again, because if there's anything else to say, then I didn't do a good job. But where did you first remember seeing this film? And now, as it's come down the road a little bit for you, what is its lasting impression on you?
So I think the first time I would have seen it, I think it might have been like on cable. Like, I think it might have been playing on like TNT or something like that, or FX or something. At some point. So I think I caught it on like TV. So I like saw it in like kind of broken pieces. So like my memory was already like kind of loose on it. And then, yeah, now as I'm like kind of doing more rewatches, I mean, I've watched it a couple more times before this episode, a time or two before the last episode. So like I'm getting it in. And the thing that's interesting now is, it's still a little bit lower on my Tarantino list. However, it has been cool to like, you know, really see all the details in the film and how those details have like kind of permeated, you know, through other films when other people are like, you know, mentioning Pulp Fiction or in, you know, even like in TV commercials, you know, music videos, like, you know, so many different parts of media have, you know, bits and pieces of Pulp Fiction just because of its iconography, you know, and like, you know, visually and like it's like, you know, quotes and things like that. So it's been cool, you know, seeing like, oh, hey, like I remember watching this one music video and they did a thing with a gold watch, or like, oh, I remember, you know, there's this one TV show episode that did an homage, you know. So it's like been cool seeing those kind of pop up.
All right. Well, I'm glad that it's slowly working its way into your cranial system, as it should. And hopefully, in the next 30, when it turns 60 and I'm dead, you can pick it up and talk about it at 60 and be like, oh, I remember back in the halcyon days of the Church of Tarantino talking about it when it turned 30.
Hell yeah.
I think when it turns 60, I will be 78 years old. I will probably be close to shitting my pants at that point. So,
hey, you gotta do one last ride for it.
I will look like the old man in Courage the Cowardly Dog. I forget his name.
Eustace.
That's right. I look like Eustace.
Let's ask our guest some fucking questions.
Now let's start with your opening questions. Our first,
number one,
who is your favorite character from Pulp Fiction?
See, it's kind of tough because I don't really have a standout. I really like just a lot of the characters, like as a collective, because it, you know, this film is such an ensemble, as all Tarantino films are, and it holds really together well. Obviously, we did a whole episode on Jules, so I would definitely say he's probably my favorite, but I do have some love for Vincent as well. He's a very fascinating character to like kind of watch unfold throughout the different segments, because like he's kind of one of the only ones that like kind of has a connection to like each little bit. So I do like Vincent, but shout out to Butch to also being maybe the only person that does anything redemptive in this film. You know, he everybody is, you know, making bad decisions and doing different things, but you know, he has his moment where he, you know, has everything he needs. He's, you know, did what he needs to do, and he could have left Marcellus to, you know, just like, you know, get endlessly fucked and probably murdered. For one moment, he was like, okay, let me be a decent person and go help him out. So I think that is like maybe the one true, like kind of redemptive thing that anyone does in this film.
It's an interesting thought to think that the redemption is he saved a man from being eternally butt raped until his death. I mean, that's your arc, right? I mean, that's, you know, someone's like, what's your good deed for the day? Well, I did go back and save a man who was trying to kill me, because I did fuck him over, from being anally raped by racist hillbillies until he died. So, I mean, I'm not asking for a cookie, but I'm just saying maybe I should get one. I think it's pretty good.
I mean, he made a choice. That is what I'll say. He made an active choice, and that's, you know, what kind of sticks out. So shout out to Butch.
Because we all know Marcellus would not have made the same choice.
No, probably not. Definitely not.
Number two.
Now, what is your favorite song from the film's eclectic soundtrack?
This one was pretty easy. It's definitely Let's Stay Together, Al Green. I think Jackie Brown has, song for song, the strongest soundtrack of any of Tarantino's films, which is all completely, you know, for the most part, soul. Mm-hmm. And so I like that we get a little sprinkling of Al Green in this one. It's a really great scene, too, because it's like it's playing while Butch is getting the instructions from Marcellus, you know, on what he's supposed to do for the, you know, how he's supposed to throw the fight. But it's showing that Butch is already in his mind being like, oh, I'm not going to do this because I got this, you know, gal that's waiting on me and we're going to run away and be in love. So it's like, I kind of like that, you know, we have the dreamy love song, you know, to kind of already put you in his headspace before Butch even says anything. Like, this is our introduction to him, you know? So it's like, I think it's a great song choice and it's just a banger track. I mean, it's fucking Al Green.
And it's also kind of ironic because as the song's playing, you know, it's talking about people staying together. And in this scene, Marcellus has asked someone to do something for him. And that person's not going to do that for him. So Butch is not going to stay together and do what he's asked. And also, he doesn't know, but Jules just showed up to let him know,
I'm also leaving. So the only, I guess the only person he's talking to, the song's playing for is him and Vincent, because that's his boy. Because two out of the three people, the major characters in the room, are saying, "Fuck you, buddy. I'm out of here."
Oh, we are not staying together.
We are not staying together.
It is a nice irony there.
Number three.
Now, what is your favorite line of dialogue and or monologue from the film?
So I guess it's a conversation. It's not a full-on monologue, but it is between, I love the conversation between Mia and Vincent at Jackrabbit Slim's. And whenever Mia just says, "Don't you hate that, Vincent? What?" And uncomfortable silence is why we feel like we need necessary to yak about bullshit in order to feel comfortable. I don't know. That's a good question. Well, that's when you know you found somebody special, when you can just shut the fuck up for a minute and comfortably enjoy silence. And I mean, I can relate to that so wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. Ironically, as somebody that does a lot of podcasts, I don't like just like small talk and like, you know, just like whatever kind of conversation. Like, and like, that's me. Like, if you want to date me, we have to be able to like sit in a room, be doing our own things in silence, but just like enjoying each other's company. Like, I have to have that. Like, I can't be around people mm-hmm. that just feel like they need to fill the void, you know? Like, hey, like we don't need to, but like just knowing that we're in each other's company, that's also nice, you know? So like mm-hmm. I relate to that wholeheartedly.
I as well. And that little speech that she says comes back like almost immediately, because it's funny, because then Vince says to her, "Well, we're not there quite yet, but don't be upset because we just met each other." But then he's the one who goes, "You know, what would you call that?" Uncomfortable silence. And she goes, "I don't know what you call that," right? You know, when the dip, and then he goes off mm-hmm. to take care of some business so he doesn't get in trouble and get killed.
Number four.
Now, what was your favorite scene from Pulp Fiction?
And sticking on where that quote came from is the Jackrabbit Slim's scene. I think is really fantastic. I think John Travolta and Uma Thurman have such a great chemistry together in their conversations and the way that they're kind of looking at each other, the dancing, everything about Jackrabbit Slim's is really great. And it's like, and it feels like this is like somewhat moment of levity throughout the film, because like, hey, and it's just a nice, you know, people enjoying a meal together, have an interesting conversation, they have a dance, win a dance contest. Like, it's just like, it's kind of a wholesome scene in a film of very non-wholesome scenes.
I mean, a lot of people do like the Jackrabbit Slim's scene. It's kind of like the calm before the storm, you know, because after this moment, I mean, obviously we had the robbery that's going to start, and we're going to eventually come back to that in the end, and then we get them going in and retrieving the case and killing some motherfuckers. But this is like that nice lull. It's a real quiet moment of the film that then leads up to her obviously having to get her heart stabbed, and then Butch on the run, and him killing Vincent, and then them getting raped and all kinds of crazy stuff there. And then we jump right back into the scene where they're taking the case and they're shooting and Marvin gets his head blown off. Like, it's the only calm moment until they get back to the diner before mm-hmm. they, you know, so there's like those two lulls right there where there's not like asshole puckered craziness in those two moments. Everything else is just fucking ratcheted up.
It's like the one moment of the film where we just get to hang out, you know? Yes. I really love that.
Number five.
And our last question for you. What do you think is in Marcellus Wallace's briefcase?
You know, I was kind of going, I was like looking at some Reddit threads and like, you know, seeing what other theories that people like coming up with. And, you know, there's definitely like, I know a lot of people talk about like Elvis's gold suit is like kind of like a concrete-ish because of connections to other films. But I mean, I don't know. I feel like the reactions that people give to when they do see what's inside the briefcase, it would be underwhelming if they're, you know, that's their reaction. So like, I don't think it's the Elvis suit, but I know I've seen other people kind of go like, oh, it's God inside, it's something else, or like, you know, blah blah blah. So if we're gonna go like because I am a horror guy, of course, so if I'm gonna go like some sort of supernatural answer to this, I think that the briefcase, the contents change depending on who is looking at it. Like kind of a reflective of something they desire, maybe their deepest desire or something like that. Like, so I feel like each time somebody else is looking at it, they are seeing something different. And that's why that's me explaining the gold glow coming from it. Because I don't think they're walking around with a case full of, you know, gold bars, because it's the 90s. Nobody was fucking doing that. So that's
not only that, when he'd walk around, he'd be clanging and banging anyways. You'd hear it. You know what I mean? Like, you would actually hear them it bang around. So yeah, wouldn't make sense.
Yeah. So that's mine. I'm gonna
I like
hop on the magic briefcase train, and it's ever changing, you know, like Vincent, he might be seeing, you know, like the cleanest coke or heroin he's ever seen in his life inside. If Butch was to open it, it would be like his gold watch, but like maybe, you know, perfected and like, you know, restored and everything or something, or, you know, it all depends on what somebody is looking for when they look in the case.
I like that answer. I like the gold lamé suit, but my only caveat, and again, I've said this before, I don't shit on anyone's theory, so if it's your theory, completely go with it. Just like when people say it's the soul, I'm always like, when, you know, Pumpkin kind of ruins that, because he goes, is that what I think it is? That kind of ruins the fact that it could be the soul, because who the fuck has seen a soul? None of us have. So it's something that he's like, your theory actually feels a little more concrete, because it would be something that he is expecting it, you know, looking at it to be. But the gold lamé, would a bald black gangster, who's one of the toughest dudes in the world, would he be actually coveting Ellis's gold lamé suit? Right? Like, that's the one time I'm kind of like, well, I mean, I like it because it would connect to what's going on, but I'm like, is Marcellus Wallace the kind of guy who's like collecting Ellis's gold lamé suits? Like, he's killing people for Ellis's gold lamé suit? Maybe. I mean, maybe it's priceless. Maybe, you know, maybe it is actually made of gold and he's going to melt it down or something like that, but it seems weird that who we know Marcellus Wallace to be, him being like, go give me that motherfucking gold lamé suit. You know what I mean? Like, you just don't see him like sending two guys to kill four dorks over a gold lamé suit. But I could be wrong.
I think it wouldn't really make sense. I mean, Marcellus, I mean, doesn't really take me for an Elvis guy. I mean, he could be a all-time fan, but like, he doesn't strike me as like the collector of sorts, or you know, like basically like a Pedro Pascal's character in Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Yeah, collecting all,
which was supposed to have a Tarantino thing in it. It was supposed to be early parts of that script were Nick Cage trying to get Tarantino to like make this like his like comeback film. That was in the initial ideas of that, but anyways, but yeah, Marcellus doesn't treat me as that sort of obsessive kind of collector type that he is going to, like you said, have numerous people murdered over this suit. I doubt it.
Cinematic journey back through time to the iconic world of Pulp Fiction. Brace yourselves as we take a deep dive into the minutiae, the brilliance, and the unforgettable moments that define this cult classic. Welcome to Pulp Reflections. For this episode discussion entitled A Wife, A Watch, and a Pulpy Situation, we will be taking an in-depth look at the unique narrative structure of Pulp Fiction and its impact on storytelling. So sit back, relax, and let the discussion begin.
Quentin Tarantino burst onto the film scene in the early 1990s with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, introducing the world to his distinctive non-linear, non-chronological way of storytelling. Rather than presenting a straightforward narrative from beginning to end, Tarantino's films jump around in time, giving audiences pieces of the story out of order. This innovative narrative structure was groundbreaking at the time and influenced many other directors. Tarantino showed that by playing with time, you could create mystery, suspense, and engaging storytelling in new ways. His nonlinear films required audiences to actively work to put the pieces together, keeping them invested in piecing the puzzles of the plots together. Beyond just the sequencing of events, Tarantino also popularized other narrative devices like intersecting storylines and unconventional chapter divisions. Reservoir Dogs, for example, uses flashbacks and glimpses of different characters' perspectives to slowly reveal the full picture. Tarantino's nonlinear storytelling opened the door for more filmmakers to experiment with chronology and narrative. His influence can be seen in many later films that similarly use fractured timelines and multi-layered stories that gradually get filled in. Directors like Christopher Nolan, Alejandro Iñárritu, and David Fincher have all cited Tarantino as an inspiration for their own unconventional narrative approaches. Overall, Tarantino's nonlinear filmmaking showed the power of playing with the convention of linear storytelling. His innovative approaches demonstrated new possibilities in cinematic storytelling and permanently expanded the grammar of film narrative in Hollywood. Tarantino's signature nonlinear style has had a major lasting impact. Now, Mr. Taylor, while Quentin Tarantino didn't invent this form of storytelling, as he was influenced by the way novels have been presenting stories for centuries, in your opinion, do you think Tarantino's unconventional story structure has more resonance with audience today versus when he started?
Ooh, that's an interesting place to start. You know, I don't know, because I feel like we were kind of getting a lot more of the kind of copycats in the more immediacy of it, like in like I'm like the late 90s, early 2000s, as I was like kind of doing my research and like kind of seeing where these were popping up. I saw a lot more of them popping up in that era than they do today. But I think because, you know, now people have kind of realized that's like you can't just, you know, like, you know, do the Tarantino copycat. Like you have to have your own identity. So it's like you can still take influence and like on how to do these. So it's like I've seen, you know, different takes on, you know, the nonlinear structure versus in like the late 90s, early 2000s. It was a lot of just like kind of copy and pasting and like kind of doing exactly what it does versus now I see people are getting a little bit more diverse in the way that they kind of tell nonlinear storytelling. And, you know, there's a few different directors that could be mentioned. And like, you know, you mentioned Chris Nolan. I think he has his own distinct style of it. Like he doesn't do the nonlinear the way that Tarantino does. But like you said, he knows Mencia as an influence. And then I'd say, like, you know, somebody like Guy Ritchie is maybe the you know, closest to, you know, as far as like being a Tarantino offspring in a way. But at the same time, him also, you know, coming up with his own distinct style in the films using that nonlinear structure.
Kind of parlayed into my next question for you. How did Tarantino's early films influence other directors to start experimenting with nonlinear narratives? And which examples stand out? You've kind of mentioned some directors, but what films do you see that stood out from the noise of the copy and paste, which is what people say Tarantino does, which obviously as you can use this as almost like a reverse engineering where you can say, oh, it's easy to copy and paste and do this stuff. And then you see people try to do it and you realize, oh, it's not that easy. And clearly, Tarantino doesn't just copy and paste. So who of the people you've talked about or films that broke through the noise and you could see, I see that there's an influence from Tarantino because of his storytelling, but this is also its own unique or its own individual identity of a project?
Yeah, so sticking in the Guy Ritchie camp, I would say Snatch. I mean, you could say there's multiple ones that would be up for debate here. Mm-hmm. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels could also be one. I mean, Wrath of Man, even pretty recently, he's still kind of doing it. Mm-hmm. But Snatch, I think, is a great example of, again, like taking a similar, like, because it's like, yes, there's like an ensemble of characters in this one, but they're a little bit more connected than they are in Pulp Fiction. But then also with, you know, Guy Ritchie being English, so he like kind of has his own different sense of humor. He has his own, you know, the dialogue's gonna be completely different because there's different slang terms and different dialects and things like that. So he has the benefit of that also, like separating it from Tarantino's voice, but in still the way that he, you know, uses like, you know, the moving of pieces around, seeing different people over here and then over here and like how they like kind of crisscross and intersect. It's not as disconnected or disjointed as like some certain Tarantino films can be. Like, again, Pulp Fiction, it's like we have this, all these different cast of characters, but like certain people never meet or certain people don't know each other. Versus like in Snatch, it's like everybody does like kind of know each other and interacts with each other just in like different pairs or different groups. And the way that they kind of bring the characters in and like everything ties together. So I think Snatch from Guy Ritchie is one of the better examples of, you know, taking the influence and then putting your own, you know, stamp and identity on it.
Now, an interesting thing about the way he does this story, which is the three-story structure, is the only other movie that does it like this of his is Inglourious Basterds, where we have three separate kind of stories. We have the Bastards, we have obviously our boy Hans Landa, and we have Shoshana. They intersect in certain spots and then don't intersect at all, because in the end, even though we've got our three main groups all back together, Shoshana's plot to set the theater on fire the night of Nation's Pride, and the bastard's going to blow it up, don't know about each other, and are both going to probably go off whether the other one happens or not. Mm-hmm. So Shauna never meets the bastards. They never meet her. They have no idea. So one of the great things about Inglourious Basterds, and I think why a lot of people also like it, without them knowing, is it follows a lot of, obviously it's a different story, but it does follow a lot of the conventions that we get from this film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, like we open up, like there are three separate stories, although he doesn't break them up into the three stories like we get in this. He does do them in the chapters again, but we, you know, we get Hans Landa, we get the bastards, and then slowly each group moves in a, you know, moves through each other, but without each other as well. And I, as much as I love Inglourious Basterds, I don't know that we get Inglourious Basterds, even from Tarantino, without Pulp Fiction.
No, 100%. Like, because then, because in Inglourious Basterds, it does feel a little bit more like, you know, it's a smidge tighter than, you know, in this one. Like, is like Pulp Fiction is meant to kind of be more sprawling. And like, even though but with Basterds, like, even though there are the three different distinct kind of groups and stories going, it's still, you know, closer together, like in, you know, the intersections of the worlds, you know, obviously, like, you know, Aldo Raines knows of Hans Landa. Hans Landa, you know, killed Shoshana's family. So it's like they are still like kind of, it's a little bit tighter, but still, yeah, uses similar structure.
And also Tarantino wanted Pulp Fiction to be more of what happens when life gets involved in a crime thriller, and where we now have the events of World War II kind of pushing the story of Inglourious Basterds, where like that has to move forward because it's just the way the wheels of war had worked. And this is more, you get a chance to hang out because there isn't that, you know, battle, you know, chess pieces being moved to bring up the immediacy of the story.
Yeah, yeah. I like the way that's described, that, you know, it, again, like it's more life influencing the plot versus the plot being influenced by life, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, the idea in Pulp Fiction was the idea of taking the, I wouldn't say film noir, but the pulp genre, all right, that was represented in the case of magazines like Black Mask, where you had Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett writing them. And so I thought the idea in the case of Pulp Fiction that would be kind of cool is to take three separate stories and make them be the oldest stories in the book, you know, whether it be Vincent's character, the hoodlum, has to go out with the boss's lady, but don't touch her. And there's a whole history of people who have touched her and what happens. Well, we've seen that before, a zillion times. All right. In the case of the Bruce Willis story, that's the boxer supposed to throw the fight and he doesn't, and now the mob's after him. We've seen that story a million times before. And one of the things I thought about, like the third story, was basically kind of the beginning of at the time of almost every Joel Silver movie, which would start off with like a couple of hitmen showing up, boom, boom. All right, you want to witness something? Witness this. And they shoot the guy, and then it cuts to Arnold Schwarzenegger walking through the forest, and eventually he's going to meet those guys. And so I thought, well, what happens if we hung out with them all night long? All day long, all right, after they've killed the guy, what happens to the rest of their day? And so it was the idea of taking these chestnuts and putting them together and then actually having the characters kind of intertwine, and it all kind of takes place in one city, and it's an environment that they all live in, and the characters kind of know each other, but you don't know that for a while, and it was just kind of the hanging out with them for those 2 days.
When Pulp Fiction hit theaters in 1994, its script stunned audiences and critics alike with its wildly original structure and style. Writer-director Quentin Tarantino, along with his friend and fellow writer-director Roger Avery, reinvented narrative conventions by telling a nonlinear crime anthology divided into three interconnected stories. The script's nonlinear structure is its most daring narrative choice. Rather than follow traditional beginning, middle, and format, Pulp Fiction upends chronology and has its stories hopscotch through time. We get key moments of our plot out of order, such as the infamous twist of John Travolta's Vincent Vega dying, not at the end, but halfway through the film. This nonlinear sequencing keeps audiences actively engaged as they work to piece the jumbled narrative threads together. Beyond order of events, Pulp Fiction also plays with narrative form. Its anthology style presents many stories centered on different characters that intersect and overlap in provocative ways. For example, Bruce Willis's Butch story starts, gets interrupted by a completely different story, and then picks back up again later. This anthology format generates contrast between the stories while revealing underlying connections. Tarantino and Avery also employed unconventional structure divisions with titled sequences like Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's Wife, dividing up the script akin to the structure of a novel. These idiosyncratic divisions foreground the short story-like nature of the film's narrative. Altogether, Pulp Fiction's groundbreaking script demonstrated that Main Street movies could challenge every rule of narrative and storytelling. Its fractured timeline, anthology format, and episodic structure were all highly innovative at the time. So much so that it was awarded the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. Tarantino and Avery proved that unconventional, nonlinear stories could still be accessible and entertaining. The lasting influence of Pulp Fiction's rule-breaking script on Hollywood storytelling cannot be overstated. Mr. Taylor, why do you think Tarantino's nonlinear style resonated so strongly and influenced Hollywood so much? And how do you think Pulp Fiction's structure impacted the way audience view and understand movies compared to more conventional linear narratives?
So I think what his, again, because you mentioned it at the very beginning, like, you know, nonlinear narrative isn't anything new, but it's in the way that it's kind of executed. And It does multiple favors for Tarantino in one, like with something like Pulp Fiction, it's like, you can take a pretty bare bones story, like, because like if you read it out, you know, chronologically, and like it's a pretty like, okay, yeah, I've seen this story in other crime thrillers, other noir type films, but using the nonlinear narrative changes, you know, the way that you are putting the story together, like in your head as you're watching it. You know, so and it's like kind of it's almost like a kind of controlling a perception in a way. I usually talk about this like whenever I'm talking about somebody like Brian De Palma, of like kind of these filmmakers that remind you that you're watching a movie and that it's a movie that they control every aspect of. You know, so like they can, you know, like you said, like take conventional storytelling and twist it to their means to get, you know, the type of storytelling that they want. So I think, you know, it's just being able to, you know, make something out of something more bare bones. I think it also like kind of gives his large ensembles like better opportunities to shine as well, as you like kind of each person rather than like, you know, going through like the whole film and you only see somebody for like a few minutes here, a few minutes there, whatever. It's like when they have a dedicated section to them, then it's like, okay, now this is this group's time to shine. Now it's this group's time. So I think that also helps like, you know, in juggling these like very large ensembles.
Now, when you first saw it and you saw Travolta die, did it confuse you when he was back? Was it jarring for you, or were you one of the people who were able to follow along? Because when I first saw the film, I saw it in the theater, and I don't think you were born yet because you're much younger than me. But I remember when I was leaving, and I've said this before, there was an older couple behind me who are probably dead now. May they rest in peace. But I remember the woman saying, now, I thought John Travolta's character died in the middle of the movie. Why was she still alive at the end? And you kind of go, oh, you missed the entire point of this film. Like, if you weren't able to keep up with it, it's like, oh, okay. So she must have sat there for the whole rest of that movie. Like, once Butch rides off and then they go back to the opening again, which she saw already, and just been, I don't know, maybe she fell asleep in her popcorn. Like, I don't know how she missed it. But when you first watched it, did you find any of it confusing, or did you find it kind of like, oh, okay, we're telling this a story this way?
I mean, it all comes together with, I think it makes it fairly easy just in the fact that we're bookended by the same, you know, like we open in the diner, we end in the diner, you know? So it's like, I feel like that, if you are confused within the movie, by the time you get back to the diner, it should all make sense, like on how we're back to that point. But I, on this rewatch, you know, all I did was pay attention to what Vincent was wearing. And that tells you exactly, because then like, because whenever Butch and Marcellus are having their meeting, you see him say hi to Vincent in the background and he's wearing the t-shirt and the shorts, you know? So it's like, oh, okay. So it's like, if you just look at what Vincent's wearing, then it kind of all makes a lot of sense and you're, shouldn't really be too confused.
Well, the other thing is, and we'll talk about it in a second, but even when we end the middle portion, he's been killed, they jump back to the very familiar Ezekiel 25:17 end of the speech, and we do the exact same thing, and then we see a guy come out, and so we go on from there. So even that, like, I feel like it was heavily breadcrumbed to the beginning.
Yeah, shows your hand, like, right from the beginning, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to do it back-to-back, like you know you just saw Vincent die, but now we're back to this point. It's like,
yeah,
okay, like, so this is, you know, what we're doing here.
Oh, you can almost see, oh, it's a flashback. I mean, the other thing it did is it could have had it been like previously on Pulp Fiction kind of like thing. So I always find it interesting when there are some people who don't follow along, because it's not intensely trying to be tricky by any stretch of the imagination. It's just telling you a story out of sequence so that you are more invested and you kind of get sucked into how things are going. Because most movies would end with them getting the case and shooting them, and that's that. I mean, normally it's like, They kill them and they show back up and they hand the case over and their boss is like, I got another job for you. You know, it's that kind of thing where this time is, what if it doesn't go as easy and smooth as that?
Yeah.
What if this accidentally happens and how do they overcome these obstacles now to get this fucking case back to Marcellus?
I like that you pointed out that, like, literally all he's doing is not giving you, like, the, like you said, like in certain movies, like when there's a flashback, they'll be like, 20 minutes before, 20 years earlier, blah, blah, blah. He's just not giving you that. And like, so it's like the nonlinear narrative also helps. And like, he's just not spoon feeding you, you know, what you're doing. But he's also not trying to trick you either. Like you mentioned, like I would say like somebody like Christopher Nolan, he does it because he kind of wants you to watch his movie like a puzzle. And like, so he is trying to like, kind of like get your brain gears moving a little bit more, trying to follow the narrative structure versus in Pulp Fiction. He's not, like you say, he's not trying to confuse you at all. And it's fascinating, like, you know, like showing flashbacks or like things like that without like those subtitles, but that at the same time, he loves his title cards. I find that an interesting juxtaposition.
Well, I think it's, again, it's from the novel, it's from his approach to the novels. Like, you know, in a novel, depending on what the title of the chapter is and who's writing the novel, sometimes the chapter of the novel will give away certain points or certain things. So I think he approached this a lot like an Elmore Leonard novel and the pulp, you know, magazines and comics he read as a kid. And, you know, he just kind of wanted to tell you that you're watching three different stories, you know, and I appreciate that. Now, he didn't go into chapters until 2 years later. So, well, let's see, Kill Bill. Kill Bill was the first time he starts going to chapters. And as much as people think he does chapters all the time, he doesn't. I think he's only done it in three films. So he did it in Kill Bill, obviously volumes one and two, but that's one giant film, whether you like it or not, because it does say chapter six when we start volume two, just in case you're not paying attention. He doesn't do it in Death Proof. He does it in Inglourious. Mm. He doesn't do it in Django. He does it in Hateful, and he doesn't do it in Once Upon a Time. So,
Interesting little pattern there.
Now, as you were speaking, we will, for those of you who don't know, now I've said it on a couple different episodes, depending on what you listen to. Sometimes you may listen to everything I say. That's fine. Who wants to hear my voice all this fucking time? Probably not. But if you do listen to some, I actually own a poster that I have above my throne in my bathroom. So when I read my Modesty Blaze while I'm having a tough time pooping out because I have heroin addiction. Now, I have a poster behind it that has the Pulp Fiction in chronological order. Someone went ahead and did an infographic poster with it all. But if you must know the chronology of Pulp Fiction, I'm sure you've written this down as well, but it would start with our flashback to the Gold Watch when we get the story of Colonel Coons telling young Butch about having to hide a gold watch up his ass for 2 years, and that his father hid it for five and died of dysentery because of it. The irony in that. Then it would jump to the morning of them in the vehicle. Driving, talking, retrieving of said briefcase, shootout, driving back, shooting Marvin in the face, going to Jimmy's house, having a conversation about storages and gourmet coffee. The wolf shows up. We dispose of the body. They go have breakfast. While they're at breakfast, they try to get robbed. They end up not killing them. They drive over to Marcellus' strip joint. They turn in the case. We meet Butch. He's told to throw a fight. From that moment on, a day later, we are now at Lance's house. We're getting some drugs. We find out one girl's got a lot of shit in her face. We're out of baggies. Got balloons. Sure, why not? We shoot up. We pick up Mia. We go to Jackrabbit Slim's. We go back. We try not to get killed, so we go jerk off in the bathroom. She overdoses on what she thought was cocaine as being heroin. Drive her back to Lance. We save her life. And then that jumps into when Butch wakes up from his story, goes out, beats the shit out of Floyd. He runs off. We chase him down. We meet everyone's favorite, Fabian. She secretly might be pregnant. He goes back to get the watch because, of course, she forgot it. Kills Vincent. Runs over fucking Marcellus with his car. They walk into the wrong pawn shop. He gets lucky, doesn't get picked first. Marcellus gets raped. He saves Marcellus' life. Marcellus tells him to get the fuck out of here while he's going to go medieval on this dude's ass. He picks up Fabian. She asks him about whose chopper is this. It's a motorcycle baby, or it's not a motorcycle, it's a chopper baby. And Zed's dead when he says that, and they drive off. End of the movie. That is Pulp Fiction in a nutshell, linearly.
Which, you know, I'm sure somebody has cut it together. And I would almost want to see it just like as an experiment, just to see how it plays out chronologically. I'm sure some nerd out there has done it, so I'll look into it. But as far as like the way that he does structure it non-linearly as the movie does play out, I would say I think opening with the prelude, the flashback to the Gold Watch, I think that would be a banger way to start the film. and then you're gonna be like, be like, who's that kid? And then later on, when we finally meet Butch, then it's like,
it does circle itself back later on down the road, and you'd have to be like, oh shit, that's right, that's why he's got to do this thing for the watch, because someone hit it up their ass.
Yeah. So honestly, I think if I were to make one choice, one change to the narrative structure of this, I would put that as the cold open, and then like after like the walking tells him about it was up his ass, everything, then bam. Title card, bam, let's go.
You could literally do the same thing, because you could do, because like when he does the watch, he puts it forward and you hear the ding, you could go, bam, da, 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 da. It could still kick the same surfer music, and then it could just do the radio, because we jump right in.
Everything else the same. That's the only change I'd make.
However, the only problem with that, though, is we're going to get into the next section, is unfortunately, we wouldn't know Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, and we would have to have two different, so we would have to cut them out, or somehow it'd be intercut and it'd be weird cutting between them and back. So that would be the one drawback to being linearly.
True. See, this is why we're not film editors.
This is why Sally Meg is like, no, we're doing it this way.
Well, no, to me, I actually think one of my strengths is my storytelling. Yeah. Because I actually am committing to telling a story. It was
because you're a writer?
More as a viewer, okay. more the fact that I just like, I like it when somebody tells me a story, and I actually really feel that that's becoming like a lost art in America.
But everybody says about you, I mean, the things that come out about you, one is a video arcade story, and growing up with your mother and loving the movies and seeing, they always talk about carnal knowledge. And the other thing that comes out is when they talk about you, and I want to talk about this a little bit later, but it is that you, in a sense, have taken novelistic techniques.
Very much so.
And translated them to filmmaking,
yes,
to
exactly.
cinema.
No, I know. That's the thing, is because to me, most movies that you see now, I mean, that used to be the thing about America, was the fact that Hollywood used to, that's what we did better than anybody else in the world. We told a really good story.
Right.
Europe was where you had character-based films or mood-based films, but America, we told a story. We're the worst at it now, as far as I'm concerned.
Telling a story.
Telling a story. We don't tell a story. We tell a situation. Most of the movies that you see nowadays, and I'm not a Hollywood basher, because enough good movies come out of the Hollywood system every year to justify its existence, but without any apologies. However, a good majority of movies that come out, all right, you pretty much know everything you're going to see in the movie by the first 10 or 20 minutes. Now, that's not a story. A story is something that constantly unfolds. I'm not talking about like this quick left turn or a quick right turn or a big surprise. I'm talking about it unfolds, all right?
Yeah, but you don't believe in a linear storytelling.
Well, it's not, it's not so much I don't believe in it. It's the situation. It's not the fact that I'm this big crusade against linear storytelling, all right? But it's the thing is, it's not the only game in town.
One of the most distinctive aspects of Pulp Fiction's storyline is its circular narrative framing device. The film starts and ends in the same diner, first with Ringo and Yolanda discussing robbing it, and then 2+ hours later culminating in a Mexican standoff between them and Vincent and Jules over Marcellus Wallace's briefcase. This circle frame provides a kind of symmetry to the otherwise fractured plot. The opening scene introduces us to the characters of Pumpkin and Honey Bunny and their reasoning for deciding to pull the diner holdup, while the end of the film loops us back to the same moment, but from Jules and Vincent's perspectives, as they discuss the validity of Jules' interpretation of the day's events that have led up to his decision to quit the life, right before proving to be more than what Pumpkin and Honey Bunny bargained for. Structurally, the circular framing contains all the fragmented stories in between within a cohesive loop. No matter how jumbled the timeline gets, unbeknownst to the audience, it always comes full circle back to its diner robbery bookends. This provides an underlining order. The circular narrative also allows Tarantino to construct how we see Ringo at the beginning and the end. When we first meet him, he's intimidating and aggressive. But after seeing his interaction with Jules Winfield, his behavior at the end seems more subdued, even contemplative. This character arc is highlighted by the circular device. Overall, the looping narrative structure adds hidden cohesion and creates anticipation in Pulp Fiction storytelling. The circular frame contains Tarantino's nonlinear chaos within an unexpected order. It allows Tarantino to hide Easter eggs within both scenes, like Vincent walking with his back to us through frame in the opening, and Pumpkin yelling out Garcon in the end sequence, cueing us, the viewer, into the fact that the film has come full circle. An unconventional yet satisfying way of tying the plot together. Mr. Taylor, how did you react when you first realized the film was looping back to the opening diner scene? Were you surprised or satisfied by the circularity of the narrative? And how important do you think the diner scenes are as bookends giving shape to the overall story? Does the circular structure work?
Oh yeah, it totally works. And I wouldn't say I was surprised, but I definitely, because I think it just makes sense. Like it is a very satisfying, and like that's the thing with this broken down narrative. Like when you look at it, he's not doing anything like super complex. You know, like he, like it's literally just take shuffling around a few different pieces, you know, doing some editing tricks in between, but it's not like super complex, like something like, you know, something that would, you know, take the circular narrative and like kind of, you know, expand upon it would be something like Memento. Like yes. That's like, you know, a very twisty kind of moral loop. Mm-hmm. And like the way that it's edited, or I haven't seen Irreversible, but from what I know of the structure of that, maybe that might also be in there. I'm also surprised that more time travel movies haven't used this kind of structure, because Primer does it. I wonder if the guys that did Primer were influenced by Pulp Fiction at all. And again, like that's like if you want the most complicated mm-hmm. kind of continuous loop circle of a movie, that movie will break your brain. But in this one, is it surprising or like super complex? No, but it's still it just makes it very satisfying. Like as soon as like you said, like when we're watching at the end and you hear Garcon in the background, it's like, oh, cool. And it's just like a, you know, so it's very satisfying and it just makes sense. And yeah.
It's also fun because I think, like you said, he's not trying to make this complicated, but he's doing a great job of hiding his parlor trick. You sit there, you get this great scene. She jumps up and says, any of you motherfuckers moving, I'll kill the motherfucking last one of you. And then we kick into the titles and then we jump into a new scene and we have that amazing chat. We meet Jules and Vincent and we learn about Royale with cheese. And then we start talking about foot massages and Tony Rucker getting thrown off a fucking building. And we slowly start to forget what the fuck just happened at the beginning and why did it stop right as it seemed like they're going to rob a coffee shop. And then we get sucked in because then they go in and they're retrieving this case. And he shoots one of them, and then he recites this thing, and then they shoot everybody, and then they disappear. And then we go into Butch, and we slowly are being pulled away. It's almost like we're in a boat, and the current is pulling us out to sea. And what we don't realize is eventually it's going to push us back in when the tides change. Because by the time we get to the diner scene, so much has happened. We've had a person get a fucking adrenaline shot in their heart. We have had them be shot at and not killed by Seinfeld lookalike. We have watched the unbelievable basement scene with a gimp and ball gags and raping and samurai swords and getting medieval on people's asses. And then we get into, go back to the structure. Oh, shit. And this guy's head gets blown off. And how are we going to rid of this body? And will you want to share breakfast with me? And when they say that we should have all gone, they're going back to the diner, but none of us.
No,
He even does a shot outside. He shows us that they're in a diner, and still none of us are like, oh, that's right. It's not until he says garçon that we go, oh, fuck. Because we think, oh, we're the calm. We've gotten through this hurdle of the Bonnie situation. We got the case, got through getting rid of the body. Man, this movie's about to wrap itself up. And then we think, we're out of it. There's one more trial and tribulation that has to happen. And that's when these two worlds come to a head. And it is very satisfying. And that's what I love about it is he's not trying to fool you. But because of the mastery of his writing ability and the acting and everything that's going on in this film, we get lulled and pulled away from what we knew was the first thing he showed us. And he showed it to us for a reason, but we forget about it. Because so much amazing stuff has happened in the 2+ hours from it that when we finally realize we're back at it, we're like, oh, shit. And I didn't feel like I would have been, like, cheated or like it was a... Like, sometimes M. Night Shyamalan movies, you're like, oh, that's the twist? Oh, while he's good at doing some twists, sometimes you're like, oh, the trees are trying to poison us? You know what I mean? Sometimes you're like, oh, they're just in the middle of a park on 9/11? Oh, okay. Like, sometimes you feel like a legend, like, oh, it's like, wah, wah. You're kind of like, oh. But I never felt that here. And that's not because I'm now doing a podcast on it. I remember sitting in the theater the day it happened and being like, oh, man, how did I not see this coming?
Yeah, I mean, it, like you said, this wasn't meant to be a trick. And, like, it almost even begs the question, like, does the film need to do this, you know, for this, like, kind of, you know, bookend? And it's like, it's... But not for like a specific, like it doesn't change anything in the plot. So it's like, it's not, that's why I always say like the difference between a twist and a reveal. Mm-hmm. Like, cause like a twist, like kind of changes the trajectory of everything and changes everything that you just saw versus this doesn't. It's just a reveal that's just like, oh, because like you said, like even whenever he says like, okay, yeah, you want to share breakfast and it's not going off our mind and it's not going off our mind when they're walking up to diner, because in the first shot, we never saw the outside. And even still, even if it is, you still go, oh, okay, it's the same diner that we saw this at the beginning of the film. That doesn't mean it's on the same day,
exactly.
But it just happens to be. So it's like, it is like, just like a more like, oh, hey, like, this is like kind of really fun in that kind of way. And like you said, I like that you said it. It's like when you get through everything that we just did, and then, like you said, you think that we come to a calmness at the end. It's like, oh, wait, no, we got one more for you. it is a very like interesting juxtaposition, like just like ending a movie in the early morning just like does kind of feel kind of weird because, mm-hmm. you know, morning is the beginning of something. And it's like, you know, and through the way that we've kind of seen the film be a pseudo anthology, it's like while you're watching, you just think that opening scene was just like, oh, that's just a random thing that's happening in Pulp Fiction world right now.
And the other thing is, with the bookends of it, what it allows Tarantino to do and us as the viewer to do is we first meet Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, and we get to like them because, I mean, Honey Bunny, what a great job Amanda Plummer did, but she's sweet and I don't want to hurt anybody. But then as soon as they're ready to go, you know, she jumps up and turns on a dime to basically turn into her persona of being a robber. So we like them in the beginning. We have no reason to dislike them. We're kind of like, oh, I can kind of see myself in there. And I'm sure there's a bunch of people are kind of like, never thought about robbing a fucking restaurant before. That seemed like it might be a good idea. And luckily that didn't turn into anything in the 90s or some from on, because I thought, oh boy, there's some copycat crimes coming up. Because he made a very good statement of why don't people right. rob them more? You know, so you're kind of like, Jesus.
Laid out a pretty good plan.
And then when we get to the other end, we have now been through a lot with Vincent and Jules, especially now in the last story. And so we like Vincent and Jules. We're rooting for them. And now when you've got these two different factions that we've liked, they're now going head to head. It gets to a point of like, who am I rooting for in this? You know, you're kind of like, I don't hate Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. And I don't hate Jules and Vincent. But now you got to pick a side. Like, who do I want to win? And it plays with your emotions. And then the way it just ends satisfyingly, where all parties except Vincent learn something in this moment, and I guarantee Honey Bunny and Pumpkin never rob again. They take that money and they're like, fuck this. We dodged a bullet today, a proverbial bullet, and we need to change our lives. Jules has already realized he needs to change his life, and the one guy who still isn't, you know, still is locked in and killing people, we want to shoot him off the counter, is obviously Vincent. And we all know what really happens to Vincent later on, like a couple days later. He finds the end at the butt end of a gun from good old Butch. So I do like the circular narrative. I do think it works really well. And like you said, Memento. Now, Memento does it a little differently, because Memento, what it does is it kind of works itself from the outside in. Mm-hmm. So anyone who watched Memento, when you were at the end of that movie, you're reaching the end and the beginning. So you're like working your way almost like in the old infinity loop where you kind of get to where the points start and you cross each other.
Yeah.
So the black and white is the past and the color is the, you know, in the present. And then you work your way into the moment. And give Nolan credit, because while he much like a Tarantino, he obviously was influenced, but he found his own way to do it. He enjoyed what he saw and made it his own. So I love both films.
I mean, Nolan kind of took it and ran with it, because like you said, Tarantino's really only done this a couple times versus yeah. Nolan kind of has made it his whole thing. You know, Tenet is kind of similar. The Prestige is one of my all-time favorites. He does yep. some twisting kind of stuff in that one as well.
Interstellar just fucks with your mind about just regular time and the difference mm-hmm. of how close you are to celestial bodies and all that. And then obviously Inception plays with reality. So yeah, I mean, I would never think or say that Nolan stole from Tarantino. I'd say he was inspired by certain things, but I'd also say he's doing his own fucking thing completely. Just like Tarantino has done. He used the conventions of novels to change his stories up, and other people have seen it and done their own thing with it.
I mean, I think the times that you see more copycat jobs is whenever they're not only doing the storytelling thing, but they also try to, you know, imitate his dialogue as well. Like, that's whenever it's like a total, like, you know, yeah. like copycat job. Because like you said, like, if you're going to take like that structure and then like do it in your own way in a completely different type of story, even like, you know, like Memento is its own kind of different
yep.
crime caper thriller. But then like, you know, but then once you're also like, okay, I'm going to do all this nonlinear stuff and I'm going to try to do like the, you know, Tarantino dialogue and stuff, then it's like, okay, like now, you know, that's where it feels more copycat. So like whenever I was like kind of trying to look at good examples versus bad examples, I was watching Lucky Number 11 yesterday. And oh my goodness, like trying so hard to do Tarantino's dialogue was so annoying. Like it was grating on me. But then once the movie settled into itself and revealed that it was doing some nonlinear stuff, but then like, and settled into itself and stopped trying to copy Tarantino, it was actually an enjoyable film. It had like a nice resolution to it. Also, Bruce Willis. So I had to get some back-to-back Bruce in here. But like, you know, so it's like you got to do your own non-linear narrative, but you also like can't just like, okay, I'm also going to like try to do the Tarantino dialogue along with it. You know, one of Tarantino's buddies, though, he had one of the better examples, Robert Rodriguez doing Sin City.
Yes.
And that
yes.
one has a anthology format to it. And he obviously probably took some notes. I'm sure he even asked Tarantino. I'm sure they had conversations about it. But like Sin City was another like effective yes. use of doing it in your own style.
Agreed. I think it's his best work to date for Mr. Rodriguez. The other thing with what you're saying about dialogue is when you brought up Guy Ritchie, well, Guy Ritchie clearly it feels like an English apprentice of his, but he uses the, you know, quick pattern speech, but also uses the English dialect from, you know, the UK dialect that us Americans would think is funny, but where, you know, if you listen to Goodfellas and you're not from America, you're like, these fucking guys, what we're talking about, you know. But when we hear the British version, you know, it's a really quick machine gun patter, and he does do things similar to Tarantino, but I've always felt that he has his own way of writing as well. Like, you know, even today, he's got a very unique way of writing his dialogue and his stories and having people talk, and I really do appreciate that fact that, I mean, because Tarantino's copying what Howard Hawks did. Mm-hmm. Howard Hawks was very quick yeah. with dialogue, but he did his own version of it. And I think the same can be said for Guy Ritchie doing his own version of what he then saw Tarantino do. But I never ever thought, oh, he's just trying to be Tarantino. Maybe early on, but he's kept this going on for his, you know, his career. And I've always appreciated what Guy Ritchie's able to do when it comes to his dialogue as well. So
yeah, it, like, because his dialogue, like, I think Guy Ritchie is even aware of, you know, us in America, our lack of ignorance to their slang and dialect and stuff. So it's like he almost uses that to where, like, you're missing stuff just because yes. you're just like, what the fuck did they just say? What does that mean? You said that and you didn't explain what that means. You know, so it's like he almost uses it in that way versus like Tarantino. He does this, you know, fast-paced dialogue, is like kind of clever things, but it's because like he's informing you of the characters. Like he's not mm-hmm. doing all these things to just make it sound cool. It's like, no, he's kind of, you know, he's telling abstract things and you're learning about a character, like how their mind works based on the way that they're talking about a burger or based on the way that they're talking about this versus, you know, so that way you don't have to just like spoon feed the audience like, okay, this is what this character is all about, like, or like this is, you know, or it's not to also like, it doesn't like spoon feed the plot either. Like the plot is still driven by the action mm-hmm. and like seeing things unfold. It's not, you know, the plot isn't given to you via the dialogue. The dialogue's about everything but the plot most of the time, you know. Yeah, they're talking yeah. about every, you know, all sorts of other shit, but like you're still getting the, you know, to know these characters and like and how they are going to influence the story, which is, you know, super cool. But again, fucking Lucky Number 11, it does what I call it like the fake Tarantino pattern that people think is Tarantino-esque dialogue, is where they'll say a thing and then the other character repeats it but in question form, and then the first person says it again and they're like so they're like, oh, well, have you ever heard of a Kansas City Shuffle? What's a Kansas City Shuffle? Well, a Kansas City Shuffle is blah blah blah. I'm just like, oh my goodness, this movie would be 20 minutes shorter if it wasn't just characters repeating what the other person is saying. And it's like, and Tarantino dialogue does not even do that. Like, but like people have it in their head that that's how you do Tarantino dialogue. And it's so grating every time I experience it.
Steven Soderbergh was able to do it, what you're talking about, but be very slick about it. So anytime you watch the Oceans movies and they're talking about something they're going to do, they just say it to each other. We're going to have to do a Rembrandt jack off paint, you know, like they have all these little terms and they know what they're talking about and they don't clue us in because we're not in their world and it could even be bullshit. But I love that about when Soderbergh did it.
For exactly. Those,
you don't have to explain everything to everybody. Sometimes that's the nice, you know, it's the fun part. Those who know are in and those who aren't, aren't. And that's just the fucking way it goes.
I learned way too much about horse racing in Lucky Number 11 for my liking. I didn't need to know all of that.
My storyline jumps all over the place.
Right. In back
fiction.
And forward.
Yeah, back and forward. Now, the thing is, the truth of the matter is, if I had written Pulp Fiction as a novel and I was on your show, you would never even remotely bring up the structure.
Flashbacks or whatever it was.
You would never bring it up. All right, because it's like a novel can do that no problem. Novelists have always had just a complete freedom to pretty much tell their story any way they saw fit. All right, and that's kind of what I'm, you know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do. Now, the thing is, for both novels and film, 75% of the stories you're going to tell will work better on a dramatic basis, on a dramatically engaging basis, to be told from a linear way. But there is that 25% out there that, you know, can be more resonant by telling it this way. And I think in the case of both Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, it gains a lot more resonance being told in this kind of, like, wild way. I mean, the thing is, I know as a viewer, the minute I start getting confused, I check out of the movie. Emotionally, I'm
confused.
Severed. Yeah, if when I'm watching a movie and all of a sudden something starts happening where all of a sudden the storyline and everything is, it gets confusing, I don't know where I'm at when I'm watching it. I think an audience has like this, you know, like almost like umbilical cord to the screen, and it gets severed when confusion comes
in. And therefore you lose them.
Exactly. And the thing is, most of the time, when I get confused and that's severed, it's basically because I'm not supposed to be confused. Yeah. All right, that's like it's a mistake. All right. However, if you get confused, there's no problem with being momentarily confused if you feel you're in good hands. Yeah. All right, and I don't think my movie and disagree if you please, is that I don't think Pulp Fiction, for all of its goings in and around
and
up and down,
how many different stories they are,
and how it goes in this big circle. I don't think it's hard to watch at all.
No, it's not.
You have to watch it. I ask for you to watch it. You can't, like, put this on video and, like, do the New York Times crossword puzzle and watch the movie.
That's right.
All right. All I ask, you put everything down and watch
Give
it.
Give me 2 hours and whatever it is, 10 minutes.
Exactly. And then once you do that, then, you know, you can follow it. It's easy to follow.
Now, in the annals of film, there may not be a more iconic MacGuffin than the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. The glowing briefcase that Jules and Vincent retrieve from Marcellus Wallace at the beginning of Pulp Fiction is a textbook example of a MacGuffin, an object that drives the plot despite having little intrinsic meaning. However, the contents of this briefcase are never revealed, making it completely ambiguous. This intentional mystery around the briefcase creates a sense of curiosity and intrigue for the audience. Throughout the film, we're left wondering what could be inside that's so valuable people are willing to kill over it. The unanswered questions linger and build suspense. By refusing to explain the briefcase contents, Tarantino makes it purely a narrative device. It exists only to set events in motion and drive conflict between characters who want to possess the unknown artifact. The contents don't matter, only that the characters obsess over it. The audience is denied the satisfaction of ever learning the MacGuffin's secret nature. This allows us to share the experience of the character's obsession over something tantalizingly mysterious. We project our own imaginations and theories onto it. In the end, the lack of resolution surrounding the glowing briefcase reflects the incomplete, nonlinear nature of the film itself. Like many elements of Pulp Fiction, it's a narrative fragment left alluringly ambiguous. The never-revealed briefcase embodies the film's unconventional yet gripping storytelling style. Mr. Taylor, in your opinion, how does leaving the briefcase contents unexplained help build mystery and suspense throughout the film? And how might the film have been different if Tarantino had explained what was in the briefcase? Would the film still have had the same lasting legacy?
If they did reveal what was in the briefcase, if they revealed it in the movie, then while you're watching it, then you're not questioning the various, you know, morality scale, like where each person falls, because then you would kind of know exactly, like, okay, this is how important that this item is to this person. This is how important it is to this person. And that's why I'm willing to double down on my opening questions thing about this, you know, it being magical. It's like each, you know, scene that this briefcase is involved in, it folds out in a different way, depending on who's in the scene, which character it is, and what their priorities are, you know? So it's like, again, the briefcase influences the scene in a different way. So like having there be a mystery to it, is just like, oh, like, okay. So like now it made this person react this way. So like, I think it's this, or this person killed this person. So now, okay, maybe it could be this, you know? So it's like, you're kind of shifting the whole time and nice and discreet to kind of get around. And I mean, who doesn't love the aesthetic of a briefcase? So, you know, yeah, great MacGuffin all around.
I think it's the best MacGuffin in all of film history. So there's just nothing else you can think of that has left itself so tantalizing 30 years later. We get a chance. I mean, it's part of my questions. We get to ask what people think, and everyone has a different answer. If you followed the show back last year in season two, when I did an episode of Under the Influence on it, we talked about Kiss Me Deadly, which is where this was kind of influenced. In Kiss Me Deadly, someone has stolen a box. When the top is opened up, there's a glow. In this particular box, it is uranium stolen from the Manhattan Project. So, and eventually it sets the entire house on fire at the end of the movie. As I said, it's been homaged also by Lucas and Spielberg. They used it in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So when the ark is open, when the Nazis look at it, they get melted away by the ghosts of the, the dead Jews from Egypt. So that's kind of where it comes from. But in this, we just, like you said, you just look at it and Vincent, we happy? Oh yeah, we happy. Close it. Never says a thing. Is that what I think it is? Even what they say is ambiguous, which again, kind of like I said about Soderbergh, you say things and you don't always have to describe it because when you're talking with somebody, you all have this this relationship with people where it's almost like they can read your mind. You don't have to say something. They know what you're talking about. You can make a mention of something or even a hand gesture and they know exactly what you mean. Mm-hmm. And the other people around you, if they don't know, they don't know. You don't stop and go, by the way, this is what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? We don't do that in life unless we're talking with somebody and we have to explain something first so they understand what we're talking about for the first time. But once you have a relationship with someone where sometimes you don't even need to speak to each other to understand looks or hand gestures and this and that, you don't then stop and tell the people next to you.
Life doesn't have time to explain, you know, the world to you, you know.
Life doesn't have voiceovers.
It's you know, it works in so many ways. And one thing that I do love, though, like, I think I will be upset if Tarantino ever does say what's
never it. Will.
I think that's so fun. Like, just like a little secret you get to take to your grave with you, like. You know, that can be, you know, one of his last dying words. What was in the gold briefcase was, and then he just passes out. That'd be fantastic. You want to know? You want to know my favorite homage to the briefcase? Is the SpongeBob episode where Patrick has a box that every time he looks his eye, he starts laughing, and SpongeBob's like, "Well, what's in the box?" And like it drives SpongeBob crazy trying to figure out what's in this box. He steals the box, and then it's just a string, and then he's like, "But no, it's actually a string that pulls open to my secret, and it's like a photo of SpongeBob at the Christmas party. It's fantastic." So like again, hilarious that like they do a Pulp Fiction homage, because what kid watching SpongeBob knows about Pulp Fiction?
That's a fun thing though, as I'm sure as you're getting older, you start to notice that a lot of cartoons have a lot of hidden adult content that the adults who are sitting there with their kids can get enjoyment because they get the jokes and the kids don't, and then the kids suddenly get it later on in life and realize that their childhood love of cartoons really had some dirty shit going on in them.
There we go. That's what is in the briefcase. It is a embarrassing photo of Marcellus at the gangster Christmas party. He was trashed and nobody can see that photo. He's got to at no matter what cost, nobody can see that photo.
Now, I believe that if kind of what you stated earlier, if we found out what was in the briefcase in the film, it wouldn't have held up. The only reason we need to know it's in the briefcase in the film is if it's going to maybe sometime play into something else down the road, like it's like a long game, like whatever's in the briefcase, many, like in his last film, suddenly comes back around and we're like, holy shit. That's the only reason that's like the long game, and that would be exciting. Like over the span of 3 decades of storytelling, he finally is like, that's why that's an important kind of thing. Because we're having a conversation 30 years down the road from when it first came out. No one knows. Tons of theories, and it's a topic of conversation that keeps that film alive for forever. Kind of like what Inception will do, where I believe the totem falls, but there are people who believe that Cobb's totem doesn't fall after he's spun it and gone out to see his kids. Nolan left that up for us. I think that's an intentional nod towards the briefcase by leaving something open, much like a Carpenter does with Is Childs an Alien at the end? Did MacReady maybe also get changed over? There's so much at the end of the thing, we don't know the answer to that either. So those movies keep alive because we don't have answers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not answering what's in the briefcase, it keeps us, you know, we never get the answer to the question of like, is what's in the case worth it? You know, was it worth all of this? And we'll never know, because since we don't know what's in the case. But if we knew, then it's like, you know, yeah, we have more kind of definitive answers for those when we have those conversations of like, okay, well, it wasn't worth it for that person, but it was for that person, you know? So it, you know, it just takes away from, you know, this kind of open-ended conversation that we're able to keep having.
Yeah, it would ruin the movie. It would not be as lasting a legacy as it currently has if we knew the answer to that simple question.
That's one of my things. Whether or not the audience knows about it, I know about the character's past, and I just want the actors to know. Now, the audience doesn't need to know. Like, for instance, Brad Pitt's character, Aldo Raine, has a rope burn.
Exactly.
Around his neck. But I never wanted to explain what happened.
I desperately wanted to know.
Well, I want you to just figure it out, all right? I mean, it's up to you to supply where that rope burn came from. I like the idea that, if you contemplate why there is a rope burn there, and somebody else contemplates why there is a rope burn there, and somebody else contemplates it, and three different people come up with three different reasons why he got a rope burn. Those are three different movies you all saw. And I like that idea. I like the idea that you open up the briefcase in Pulp Fiction, and I don't tell you what's in there, but it's up to you to figure out what's in there, and now that's your movie. And you'll make that decision somewhere down the line. Now, if I tell you at this table what it is, then you'll throw that away, and I don't want you to throw away. That's your movie.
Now, the influence Pulp Fiction has had on film and TV narrative structure is enormous and is still felt today. When it was unleashed upon the world in 1994, its nonlinear storytelling style was groundbreaking and went on to inspire countless filmmakers and TV show creators. One of its biggest impacts was proving that mainstream audiences could still enjoy and engage with nonlinear, non-chronological narratives. Tarantino showed that fractured timelines with interconnected stories could work as high entertainment. This opened the floodgates for more films and shows to use unconventional experimental story structures. Pulp Fiction made nonlinear narratives far more mainstream and accessible. Directors like Christopher Nolan, David Fincher, and Alejandro Iñárritu have all cited Tarantino's influences on their own acclaimed films, with tangled timelines like Memento, Fight Club, and Amores Perros. His style also spread into prestigious TV shows like Westworld, True Detective, and Mr. Robot. Beyond sequencing, Pulp Fiction popularized interweaving multiple storylines and ensemble casts rather than a single protagonist. Its black comedy and mixing of genres showed new possibilities for tone and style. Tarantino also demonstrated the power of exaggerated, idiosyncratic dialogue that became widely copied. While not the first nonlinear film, Pulp Fiction proved this unconventional form could be commercially successful. It changed public appetite for what stories cinema could tell and how they could be told. Pulp Fiction's enormous pop culture presence cemented nonlinear narratives as a compelling, mainstream form that resonated for decades to come. Its creative influence is still highly visible in film and TV today. Mr. Taylor, in your opinion, what made audiences embrace the fractured timeline of Pulp Fiction when nonlinear plots were not yet common? And how did Pulp Fiction change public appetites and expectations for narrative originality in cinema?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is a bit of the time that came out, because like this is, you know, mid-90s. And coming from the 80s, which obviously, yes, have a lot of great movies, a lot of, you know, blockbuster popcorn film. But it was also kind of that. Like, it was also just like, you know, there was a formula to every single type of movie that came out in the 90s or in the 80s. And that's why it was such a popular, you know, popular decade for film. So it's like we kind of just had the formula down for any type of movie. You knew how a certain, you knew how a sports movie was going to go. You knew how a horror movie was going to go. Like, you know, we just like kind of had all these things down. So I think just, again, like him doing something very simple of just like kind of, you know, going with this broken timeline. And it just must have felt very fresh at the time compared to, you know, what had been coming out for the better part of the past, you know, 15 years up to that point. Because if you, you know, look back in cinema, like in the 60s and 70s, whether it be Hitchcock films or, you know, like, you know, Italian films of the time, giallo films were doing some interesting story structured beats as well in the 70s. So like things were happening before, but then we just had this like kind of 10-15 year timeline of just like kind of a lot of the same formulaic ways of storytelling. So it just must have felt very fresh at the time.
And I mean, as you talked about, we could see copycats that just flooded the movie screens in the mid to late 90s into the early 2000s. And we still see them. I mean, they're still out there. There's plenty of people who still try to copy, you know, do some Tarantino-esque things. Some do it well, some do it horribly. I mean, there is an actual list on IMDb of about 240 Tarantino-esque films. That's the list that's called. It's Tarantino-esque. And different titles get added as they become available. Some of them, there's a few on there that could be taken off. I don't think they're Tarantino-esque. One of them being The Usual Suspects. And The reason I say that is it came out in 1995 and was in production when Pulp Fiction came out. So it's kind of hard to copy something while you're in production, while it's being put out. So, you know, there's obviously you can see some beats, but I think they're different stories. But there are plenty that are still being put out that you can go, okay. A movie called Sisu recently came out, and it had heavy, heavy Tarantino vibes, especially when we talk about like Inglourious Basterds. Now, obviously, it wasn't the same movie. It was a movie from Norway, and I was hoping it was going to be as good as the trailer, but it was just a decent film. But he's still influencing people even today, 30 years later, and many TV shows have really started to kind of use it because you have multiple storylines. And again, it makes sense. Because when you're talking in TV, we are talking more of a chapter-like structure. Because every episode is technically another chapter in a book. So playing with timelines and playing with what happens here and there really does work really well for television. And I think, you know, I think TV has been able to reach out and kind of use this this style because it saw that it worked in film. And so it's easy going to parlay itself into TV, especially once you see the fans are actually up for this kind of material and this kind of storytelling device.
Yeah, I mean, again now, because obviously with different editing technologies and things like that now, we are kind of able to do different things. So like we're seeing new ways that people are, you know, kind of telling these non-conventional. It doesn't have to be, you know, the three-story kind of split. It can be just like maybe a two-story split, or it can be even more than that, you know? So it's like we're kind of seeing the differences in that way. And the differences in, like, again, like relevance to the plot itself. Because again, like really the fractured timeline of this doesn't really like impact the story super heavily. Like, I mean, it's really there just to be kind of different and to be kind of cool for real. But then there's other movies that do kind of more rely on that structure and not in a bad way. Like some of them like that, again, like some movies are kind of meant to be a little bit of a puzzle, you know, in a way. And that's totally fine. Like, again, like fucking Tenet most recently, like a few years ago, like that is Nolan memeing himself, his own obsession with time, which is like in his, obsession with non-linear narratives, which he got from Tarantino, you know, and like Tenet makes no sense and it's not supposed to. And that's the best part about it, because he's like, oh, hey, look, I'm doing this thing. Can you keep up? And then it's just like, it doesn't really matter.
It's like the little card game that people play on the street. So where's the coin under? And they keep moving. You're like, I don't know. I lost about 20 seconds ago. The one thing I would say about this nonlinear structure that obviously comes from novels, that really was kind of where, and not the first one to do it, but I think why it works, and not just because it's because of Tarantino, but what it does is it forces you, the viewer, especially if you're, you know, you're a fan who wants to watch. Sometimes people just want to put on a movie and turn their brain off, and that's perfectly fine. There's plenty of Adam Sandler films out there and films like that you can absolutely sit down and enjoy the hell out of them and just not have to think about it. And that's perfectly fine. I like those movies as well. But for the viewer or connoisseur of film who really enjoys a film that challenges them, that forces them to be invested from the first frame to the last, this kind of storytelling does that. And I think there are people who sometimes also like to see if they can guess where the story is going before it gets there, see if they can be ahead of the, you know, the director or not. And I do like a film like these because it is engaging. That's what I like about Christopher Nolan. That's what I like about Fincher. That's what I like about even Kubrick. I like people who challenge me while I'm watching the film. I don't want to just be able to sit there and go, I know exactly where this film is going. Unless, of course, like I said, I just want to sit there and enjoy a comedy. But a drama and an action film or a crime film, you should not be able to sit there and go, I know exactly where this is headed. Because when you do, it takes you out of the film and you get disappointed quickly. And you go, Jesus, I wish I had fucking wasted my time on this. And I think there's nothing moviegoers hate more than feeling like you got your fucking time wasted and that someone just tried to do a money grab and didn't even fucking give a shit about the film that they're, you know, putting in front of people.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely say I am guilty of being one of those people that likes to like try to predict stuff sometimes, you know, and be like, oh yeah, I know where it's going, like her. But the thing is, I go into a movie hoping to be, you know, subverted or outsmarted in that way. Like, you know, if it can do that, and I'm like, oh, okay, thank you. Like, that's, you know, I wanted to not be able to guess what was going to happen. So like, I really do appreciate it from that angle. I think if I had to think of, but not in like a not a very challenging film, by like the way that you like were kind of differentiating, you know, the importance due to the subgenre, like whether like a, yeah, like a comedy thing, you know, you're not, you know, it's okay if you can predict stuff, you know, versus like you said, like a crime something. But I think it works in a horror film very well, just in the way that like, you know, because horror films already aren't kind of tethered to conventional narrative rules. So you can already like kind of have, you have more wiggle room and it's like a little bit more okay. And like, and people aren't going to like poke theories in as much, but not a very deep film, but I think the closest like one-to-one as far as like the structure goes would be a Trick or Treat Mike Dougherty, which is like a pseudo anthology. And like, it almost does the exact kind of thing. It like has a, you know, bookend, you see one character die, but then come up later in another segment. Like, so it's like, it does a very similar thing, actually.
I think horror could use a little bit of more of this kind of storytelling device, because we do get kind of lulled into, oh, another possession movie. There are a few that break the mold sometimes. And I think horror would do well if, you know, if we were kind of thrown off and not sure where we were in the story, it would add more tension to some of the things. You know, instead of just trying to get jump scares, we might get a little bit more invested in some of them. Because, you know, we're in what I call, because now as we record, we're at the end of February. But this is the possession season. This is when all the possession movies from January to March come out. Something's possessed every other week, it feels like. And you're like, okay, another doll, another sneaker. It's a book. Like, after a while, you go, okay, all right, we know how this is going to go. And you kind of want it to change up a little. I wish horror would actually do more homaging of nonlinear and try to steal from that, because I think it would, like you said, it does have like this open-ended playing field where a horror movie can be supernatural. It can be anything. Like, it's one of the genres where it literally can be anything. And they would probably be well suited for more of that playing around and messing things up a little bit, making it not so, you know, oh, the killer's going to do this thing and then they're going to die, but they're going to come back at the end of the credits and we'll have a sequel. It'd be interesting to just kind of play some of the non-conventional storytelling that would might help inject a little more excitement into some of the horror movies and make them not just all kind of like rom-coms where you go, oh, I know how this is going to end, kind of, you know, oh, all right, there's going to be some cool kills, maybe some nudity, but at the end of the day, Final Girl's going to win and we're all going to go home waiting for the sequel, because that'll be pitched at the end of the credit sequence.
Well, I apologize to my contributions to Possession season, because I am at every single one of theaters. I'm a slut for a possession movie because they do go the exact same way every time. That's kind of part of the fun of possession movies as a subgenre, because they are so formulaic. But yeah, I'll hook you up with some art house picks,
please. Yes,
for you to watch to scramble your brain a little bit.
Fantastic.
Do you write longhand still? Or
absolutely.
You do. Why?
Can't write poetry on the computer, man.
Wow.
You could creatively. You could think better if you just have the pen in your hand.
No,
right?
That's exactly. Well, that's how I've always done it. It's, you know, I've kind of. Yeah. I don't even know if I believe in God, but I do feel that, you know, my pen is my antenna to God as far as writing is concerned. But you know, actually, the way the process has kind of evolved though, is I actually ignored this part of the process for about for like the middle point of my career and got back to it on Inglourious Basterds, and now I'm like, how could I have ever stopped doing this? Was when I wrote Reservoir Dogs, I wrote it out. Normally, when I'd written something before, I couldn't type. I would talk friends into typing things up for me. Well, I used my last friend as far as that was concerned.
Enough of
this typing shit, all right? I'll drive you to the airport, I'll help you move, but fuck typing your shit. And fair enough. So in that case, I wrote Reservoir Dogs longhand, and I had to type it up. And I couldn't type, and I didn't even have a typewriter. I borrowed my girlfriend at the time, her little Smith Corona word processor from 1987, her Smith Corona word processor / typewriter with like a little floppy disk with a memory of 30 pages on it. It's for college kids doing papers. And so I borrowed it, and I just typed it up one finger at a time. And that's how I did Pulp Fiction. And I kind of got away from that, and I went back to it again in Inglourious Basterds. Again, I using her Smith Corona word processor. All right, I'm kind of superstitious about that. Also, it's idiot proof. I can't fuck it up on that.
That's
thing,
true.
Know?
Yeah.
But you know, literally, the whole process of me writing by hand when I now have to type it up by one finger and just literally, I don't trust it to hold anything from memory. So I print up every page as I finish.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good idea.
But, you know, it's, that's an important part of the process to me. That's like the, you know, that's the final draft coming out there. I mean, because I do tend to, I think people do, you tend to overwrite when you're writing by hand because it's just costs you nothing. To just blah, 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 blah with the pen. But when you gotta type it up with one finger,
this better be
if
some
the
important
shit
stuff.
Ain't motherfucking Shakespeare, it's got to go.
Never thought of it like that. Yeah, yeah. It better be important.
It better be good.
All right, well, it's time for your three for the road. We have made it through. You've survived your second episode.
Here's three for the road.
Now, what kind of impact do you feel this film has had on the movie industry since its debut almost 30 years ago?
Yeah, I think what we've mainly been talking about is that, like, you know, showing that it's like, hey, like, let's not, like, you know, ever get kind of content in, you know, the ways to tell a story. Like, let's find new ways and, you know, fuck with the format a little bit more. Like, you know, fuck the Save the Cat book. Like, you know, write it the way you feel like writing it, you know, even if it is just for like a little bit of extra style, who cares? But I think this film is like kind of impacted the industry. And like, obviously, yes, like people do kind of go for this type of style when they like do certain crime thrillers. And so, yeah, it's had its negative impacts. But at the same time, it has pushed other directors to, like you said, be able to, you know, come up with different ways to tell stories. And I think, you know, he, again, like, he didn't set the template for it or anything, but he, you know, showed, you know, that it could, very old technique, like you said, like, you know, dating back to books, can still work today. So it's like, we can always kind of have that. And I think the film also is a really great way, again, of like handling an ensemble cast on like showing that you can, like, you know, you don't need to have a lead protagonist and you can like have a movie of side characters and it works, you know, like, because if you just do it in a very interesting way, then it can definitely work. So it's like it's had its impact there. And then as far as just like, you know, obviously his script, the storytelling within it as well. And, you know, it is a quote machine. But at the same time, all these conversations do, you know, endear you and you learn so much about these characters through, you know, these, you know, very interesting conversations. So it's definitely had a big impact on not only the way people write story, but also the way people write dialogue, the way they treat ensembles. I think the film has had effect on all of that.
And kind of piggyback on what you said, you know, as you're saying, I kind of thought, you know, we actually had three rotating leads. You know, like each person, someone else leads a section of the film. And that's a rarity in films even today, where normally you've got, you know, you got your lead, you got your supporting cast, and that lead's going to lead the entire time, where Travolta's our lead in the Mia Wallace story. Butch, obviously, we got Bruce Willis leads that one. And then Sam Jackson really leads the end because he is more prevalent in the front and the forefront. And he gets the last word. So we have three male leads that kind of rotate depending on what story is being told. And that's a rarity. Even we see it in Inglourious Basterds. There are different leads in each segment. And like you said, sometimes those leads from the other story come in and now they're kind of supporting characters. They're not in charge of what's going on in the film. And other people now take a backseat or a push to the forefront. And it definitely helped change a few things in that respect. And, you know, showed that big time actors can also work in ensemble pieces. And it's not always just about them. Who knew?
Right. It doesn't have to be just like, okay, we get one A-lister and then let's surround it by the C-listers, you know, to like, again, like make it a point. Like, this is the lead person. It's like, no, it like doesn't have to be that way. That's why it was like, that's why it's like hard for me to pick a favorite character in this, because I'm like, I really like so many people. Mia's cool. The drug dealer guy, he's cool. The wolf. I mean, so it's like, it's really hard because when the ensemble is just that strong.
Now, in your opinion, what has been Pulp Fiction's most enduring impact on pop culture?
It's hard not to say the quotes, because I feel like this is got to be like easily top 10, like, you know, most quoted films, you know, especially on the internet. And so, I mean, it's kind of hard to go that way. But I kind of want to go off what you were just saying about the, you know, power of these casts that he assembles, like, you know, and like to like kind of take, you know, go to a time and be like, wow, at one point there was a director that people were so interested in working on that he's able to wrangle Samuel Jackson, John Travolta, Bruce Willis, you know, Uma Thurman, like, you know, he's able to, you know, gather all these people and like and you can, you know, watch it. And then like, obviously watching it 30 years later now, it's like, oh, like I'm watching it. And it's like, these are some of the best, you know, actors of their time, you know, putting in some of their best work. And like, that's, you know, so cool to still see and like how, you know, where they were at various stages, you know, mm-hmm. John Travolta, that was kind of a comeback for him versus that was kind of a star making performance for Jackson, you know? So it's like, it did different things for that as well. So it's like being able to look back on that, I find very fascinating.
And it's echoed to even his last movie as we record, obviously it's, there's still some rumors, but there could be Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt in the same film and they're going to be supporting actors because they're not playing the lead. And to grab two big Hollywood names, who usually are the star of big budget films. Do you have that kind of cachet to be able to grab guys like that who are going to do some kind of like maybe be on screen 15 minutes, maybe 20? You know, like you said, Robert De Niro was a supporting actor for Jackie Brown. Al Pacino was in the last film, Once Upon a Time. He's on screen 10 minutes, maybe. He's in the opening. He does a little extra towards the end and boom, we're out. And these are leading guys that people know,
yeah.
You know? So mm-hmm. it's amazing mm-hmm. that, you know, the trust that he has earned through not just writing, but his ability to work with actors and his ability to give them juicy roles that a lot of times it's got to be in their top five movies that they've done. Usually when they've been on a Tarantino project.
100%. 100%.
And finally, where does this film rank for you in the Tarantino filmography? And I know it's not high because we've had that discussion, but where is it currently ranking for you? And it may change as this journey continues, but where is it currently as we speak?
So yes, it is towards the bottom, but I mean, of course, the bottom is, you know, still not a bad movie ever. But so it's at 8 out of 10 right now. In front of Reservoir Dogs, right behind Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I have not rewatched in a long time. Like, I don't think I've watched that movie in like 3 years. So, since I've been doing my rewatches of this one now, mm-hmm. I'll have to revisit Once Upon a Time and see if Pulp Fiction makes the leapfrog over it. But as far as the rest of my list, though, it's pretty cemented as far as like what I enjoy. I enjoy his more later stuff than I do his earlier stuff.
What's your number one?
My number one is Django Unchained. Mm. I love that film. Django Unchained. Hateful Eight made a nice rise to number three after our scene study episode. Mm-hmm. That one has kind of crept up, but yeah. So I just have other films just based on, you know, what they're doing, because again, like, he doesn't do this often, and I would say, like, even though I do enjoy watching this film, I am more compelled by his more kind of straightforward narrative features.
And that's a wrap on this month's edition of Pulp Reflections. I would once again like to thank my special guest, Mr. Devon Taylor, co-host of the Spectre Cinema Club podcast and host of the Courage the Cowardly Pod, for joining me today. I had an absolute blast discussing Pulp Fiction's unique narrative structure and how it impacted the modern storytelling of both film and television. Now, you can find the links to all of Mr. Taylor's endeavors and his show socials in our show notes. And as always, you can become a member of the Church of Tarantino by following us on all of our socials. Those links can be found in the show notes as well. Now, if you'd be so kind to take a moment to like, review, subscribe, and follow us, the Church would greatly appreciate it, as it will help other fellow Tarantino fans like yourself find the show. So be sure to join me again next week as Mr. Phil Duke, host of the Making Tarantino podcast, joins me on our quarterly Tarantino speculation series as we take a look at all the happenings, rumors, and speculations currently swirling around in the Tarantinoverse. There may even be a Church exclusive insider info on some movie critic casting. So until then, I'm the Reverend Scott K. May Tarantino be with you always.
This has been a Man with an Exceptional Beard production.